The following is a presentation of Morning Drive Media and the Wrestling Viewpoint Network. Welcome back to the Wrestling Viewpoint Network and California Classic Wrestling Episode 2. We are so happy to have you guys back and along for the journey that has been Wrestling Viewpoint Network. And with me, as always, for California Classic Wrestling is Dan Farron.
Oh, thank you, Ken. It's good to be here back for our second edition.
Can I call you Dangerous Dan Farron?
Actually, when I first started refereeing, they did call me Dangerous Dan Farron, but it kind of sounded stupid for a referee, so they dropped that part.
You're saying referees shouldn't have gimmicks, is that what you're saying, Dan?
Some referees. I'm an old-school referee. I'm a little bit different than that.
California Classic Wrestling, as most of you know who are listening, is a show dedicated to the fine, wonderful history of California wrestling, going back from the turn of the century up until 1982, as deemed the end by Dan Farron.
That's and by most of the people in professional wrestling. When there's no more work, it is the end.
It is the end. And tonight's show is great. First episode, we called California 101, which you kind of went over the history of the wrestling. Because we're bridging the gap here. We got people who lived this history, and we got people learning about this history. Mm-hmm. So we're bridging the gap and getting you to catch the vibe. That was the first episode. But this one, we're going to focus on one particular night. August 27th, 1971, at the L.A. Coliseum, the biggest wrestling card in the history of the world. And you say it, Dan, you say this is probably the most important card in California's history.
Yeah, there have been several really big arena-based cards over the years, but I would say that this is the card that people remember as the high water mark. For Southern California wrestling. And this has an amazing story to it and also has a lot of lessons for people in wrestling on how to build a show and how to get to a show.
We're not going to talk about every match on this card. We might mention it, but we're going to go into detail on some of the bigger ones, of obviously in the build and the main event. But let's run down, Dan, what the card was.
Right.
Let's set the tone for the people. If you were heading out to the L.A. Coliseum, here's some of the matches you were seeing. I love some of these names, too. Grand Marcus versus Sunni Warcloud.
Right.
You got Bobo Brazil. We've all heard of Bobo Brazil. He was in a grudge war with the Sheik.
Right. Mm-hmm. They brought that out. So that makes sense. Bring that match out. It's very popular. It's going to draw.
Absolutely. Paul DeMarco versus Cowboy Lane.
Right.
Two out of three falls.
Right. That's back when they used to do that. A whole different psychology.
Right.
Paul DeMarco eventually became a Russian wrestler on the AWA right after that. It's funny how they wind up in different roles.
Smart move. Now, I've been struggling with this name all night, so help me through it.
El Psicodelico.
Psicodelico.
The brother of Mil Máscaras, the great Mil Máscaras.
I love that name, and he was fighting Fidel Castillo. And also we had a
I'm Irish, and I'm sounding more Hispanic than you are.
Well, we had Los Medicos de Mexico versus Apollo and Earl Maynard.
Right.
Also, we had some girls' championship action.
Girls might have been a polite way. They were women by that time, I tell you. It's a
Fabulous Moolah was defending against
Betty Nicolai out of Kansas City.
And
yes.
Raul Mata fought El Solitario in a world light heavyweight championship
match. Raul Mata is one of Kurt Brown's favorite wrestlers of all time. He is in Florida, and El Solitario kind of sadly died several years after this at a very young age.
And that match was sanctioned by the NWA.
Right.
And then we had a U.S. title event. Dutch Savage out of Pittsburgh was the challenger to Peter Maivia.
And everybody knows Peter Maivia.
Absolutely. And America's tag team title match, we had Black Gordman and Goliath from New Mexico. They were the challengers against Kenji Shibuya.
Right.
And Masa Saito.
Mr. Saito, yes.
Absolutely. And El Gran Lothario. I love that name. El Gran Lothario versus Ripper Collins. But in the main event, Dan, this one was for revenge.
Right.
Two out of three falls or to a one-hour time limit. We had in one side from Canada, John Tolos. And then we had Freddie Blassie.
Right.
Now, both these men had long careers on both sides of this match.
Right.
But this was the main event. That sets the tone at the L.A. Coliseum Friday, October, Friday, August 27th, 1971.
Yeah, this show is very important to California wrestling history and probably to wrestling history in general.
Yeah,
it was at one time referred to as the biggest show, in wrestling. I mean, there are guys that crunch numbers and attendance and all that stuff that would get into that.
It isn't about attendance,
but it isn't always about attendance.
No, it's not.
This was about promoter Mike LaBelle taking a chance, and back then there weren't a lot of shows in '71 being done outside. There were occasion situations, but in Los Angeles, again, as we spoke about last time, it's I think Mike LaBelle used to tell Jeff Walton he thought there was about 10,000 wrestling fans in Los Angeles because that's what could fill the Olympic Auditorium, and he felt outside of that that there wasn't a chance of that happening. So what's amazing about this card is that it's a card that historians, no matter they're Los Angeles or wherever, remember fondly. It proved a lot of things. It proved that a long build to a show, a big show, could work. And that was something that the Vince McMahon applied toward WrestleManias and big pay-per-views and arena shows and Coliseum shows after that. It also proved that if you take your time and publicize anything and really not lose faith. So often these days, people, they want most of the independent promoters and the promoters, even the big groups now, if it doesn't click for them right away, they get scared.
It boils down to a phrase you and I, Dan, talk about often, the hotshot booking.
Yeah, hotshot booking.
That's what it turns into.
I hate hotshot booking.
Yeah. I mean, every once in a while, when it's a surprise,
when
it's not
it
the norm,
yeah,
it does what it's supposed to do, but everyone latches on to the big,
Well, a lot of people, the theory there is that people say, well, people don't have patience for that anymore.
Mm.
I don't personally believe that's completely true. I think what happens is in a lot of situations, people who are in charge of wrestling become panicky that it's not working, I gotta change it right now.
Right.
And sometimes you just have to stay the course a little bit longer and see what happens and see what develops.
Tell the story right.
Tell the story right.
To tell the story right.
And take two guys in your main event who were not strangers and had not ever, and it's not like they had never wrestled before. No, these guys, you can find kinescopes of them on opposite sides of a tag team match in the 1950s. So, and Blassie himself had said to Tolles at one point, I think we can make some money together. And Blassie in his book said, I didn't realize it would be almost 15 years later before we did. You know, and it a lot is, and also this card had a lot to do with the birth of wrestling pay per view, and we'll get to that in a little bit too. So there was a lot of things at stake, as there always are when you take a chance this way.
Yeah,
but there were a lot of things that were proven by this show, it's unusual. On the Pro Wrestling Observer website, every year when the anniversary rolls around, Dave Meltzer always remarks that more people say, hey, this is the anniversary of this show, because they latch onto it and they memorize it. And it's one of those shows where I tell you, I have never met a person who went to it.
Really?
Really and truly. I know they're probably out there.
Well, I'm hoping that we get it. We're called to action right now.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing also is they talk about, oftentimes people say to me all the time is about the videotapes. Where are the videotapes of these shows? I mean, in general, the old shows. And the truth of the matter is it's something we don't want to hear, and that is it costs money to keep these tapes, and no one ever figured you're going to use them again. So a lot of the times they were just recorded over.
Right.
This show was done on closed circuit also. I'm hoping somewhere in somebody's basement there's an old videotape existing of this
show. Nephew or a grandson's going to clean out someone's closets and...
Don't throw anything away,
discover
folks.
Discover this. It's either going to be a videotape of Stan Musial hitting, or it's going to be this card. All right, that's my prediction there. So let's set a little bit to Blassie and Tolles.
Right.
you mentioned that's fascinating that Blassie, yeah, we can make some money 15 years later.
Right,
that's
hard. Exactly.
It's funny to wrap your brain around that.
Yeah, it is.
Dan, go into a little bit about those two gentlemen.
Well, you take Fred Blassie, who wrestled out here in the 1950s. Actually, it's funny. By the time that Freddie Blassie got to Los Angeles, he was in his mid-30s. He had started wrestling in 1935.
Wow.
By the time he got to Los Angeles in the 1950s, he came out as part of a brother, not really a brother, but a wrestling brother.
No one in wrestling is really...
Yeah, exactly, in most cases. A guy named Billy McDaniels, okay. And he came out as Fred McDaniels, and they were the McDaniel brothers. And right. They came out here in around 1952. And Blassie fell in love with California. Mm-hmm. For him, he could tan. He could, right. He could do all that stuff. And I was very lucky enough to meet Fred Blassie and to know him for a while in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. And we exchanged letters. And he had excellent penmanship. I can tell you that. I still have them. But
he seemed to be very good at that then, because that's how Jeff Walton
exactly.
got it. Right.
That's exactly.
Exchanged letters with Blassie.
Les Blassie. And he was the nicest man in the entire world. And when we got to be friends, I wrote to him one time and said, hey, I have some friends who are fans of yours who they don't really follow wrestling anymore because everybody out here knew Freddie Blassie.
Right.
And I wrote to him, and he sent my friends three color 8x10 personally autographed photos
wow.
of Fred wearing a sombrero, the famous picture of Freddie wearing the sombrero. And he was just the nicest guy in the entire world. Mm-hmm. And but he was just a hellacious wrestler. I mean, right. when he got into the space and when he got into that spot, he would just go. But he loved California. He used to say to me, he says, I love coming out. I can tan between my fingers. He says, and when I get when I tan too much and something pops up, I just have the doctor cut it off. but so he wanted to return. So he did come back to Southern California a little bit later on under his own name, Fred Blassie.
Right.
About that time, he meets John Tolis. Tolis is about 18 years younger than mm-hmm. Blassie at this point. And they wind up being neighbors in Santa Monica when they're out here working. And he likes Tolis, and Tolis likes him. And it makes perfect sense. They are the perfect dance partners. I use that phrase a lot, but they were the perfect dance partners. They both had quick wits and sense of humor. They were both two of the most amazing interviews. Mm-hmm. in the history of wrestling, and they were kind of brawlers. I always described, to me, John Tolis, and I will admit this, John Tolis is my favorite Southern California wrestler.
Okay.
John Tolis could have been Steve Austin. Whenever he turned face, he wrestled a heel type program.
Well, that's what I'm going to ask you. I was going to throw a curveball at you here. And for the listeners out there who are learning about all this stuff, can you do that thing that might be sometimes frowned upon? Compare them to someone. Who are we looking at in a current generation? Going back 10 to 15 years.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard. I mean, because of the way the characters were set up, mm-hmm. they developed their own characters.
Gotcha.
Now, Austin developed that character too.
Sure.
But the thing I remember about Tolis, when Tolis was wrestling, whether he was a heel or a face, mm-hmm. is that he still wrestled that same style. It's just the fans cheered for him. But right. he was they were both kind of brawlers. Blassie is hard to match up with anybody.
Which is why he's a legend. But I'm just trying to put it into some kind of context that some other people can grab out there.
I would say probably... I don't think there was anybody like Fred Blassie.
There you have it,
tell you the truth, I really don't think anybody currently who works that same style. If you pull up on YouTube, there's some wonderful interviews with Freddie from the 1950s.
Yeah,
he was so politically incorrect. He was amazingly politically incorrect. He would call the women pigs. He would say they come out and they should dress in form-fitting clothes. They shouldn't dress in baggy dresses. And used to make people go crazy. But at the same time, he would the thing about Tolis and Blassie was whenever they were heels, people kind of liked them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And whenever they would come... If they were a heel and you were like to come toward them or whatever, they would take one step towards you and everybody would run.
Yeah, right.
Because they feared them. Because they knew that deep down they were pretty tough guys.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they had to. These are guys that were constantly being stabbed, were having things thrown at them, you know, just all kinds of of hell. And they also were always the best when they were booked against either really good, as they referred to them, as white meat baby faces, I mean, that the fans just loved, or, you know, you could always bring in the Sheik. You could always bring in, you know, some rule breaker or whatever, and put them up against them in a heel versus heel match, and they're always going to, they're still going to be the local hometown boys.
And I love hearing you use that term rule breaker, because when I started watching in the 80s, I didn't know heel face like so many people know now.
Exactly.
I knew good guy and rule breaker.
Yeah, exactly.
And I used that term well into the 90s, and then it was like,
I still like to use it. Yeah. I still feel weird using heel and baby face sometimes, only because everybody else uses it.
It's just now it's a thing, you know. Now now people know what that means.
Well, a lot
of
people use it, and they don't really know exactly what it means.
Sure.
You know. But with Tolis, like I said, Tolis was another guy. Like I said, I was lucky enough to not know him really well, but to meet him. And I actually went to John Tolis' funeral. Because it was like an ending, a part of my childhood, and I kind of felt I wanted to be there. And Tolis lived in Woodland Hills, which is not that far away from where I live. He worked out there, and oftentimes if you were driving, you would see him out walking. He was in amazing physical shape, even as he got older. And I used to tease my wife. My wife rolled the window down, and she would go, "Golden Greek," like that to him. And he would go, "Right here, baby," like that, you know. And Tolis started out with his brother Chris, and they were a tag team, and they held the belts in the WWF and all over the place. And as they went, Tolis developed this interview style that was cocky and arrogant, but kind of funny at the same time. And he and his brother came up with a catchphrase, which was kind of unusual for back then.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of them would finish. And it was a way also to tip them off that it was their turn to talk, which is a smart way to do it. He would go, "Right, Brother Chris," and he'd go, "Right, Brother John." And that was their way of going. Chris eventually went back and didn't like the travel as much. John kept going as a single. And he was not neither Blassie or Tolis were luthes. Okay, they weren't great technical workers, but they had what they called fire, and that is they could get a crowd behind them mostly by stomping, kicking, or jumping around. John Tolis had this great move that whenever somebody would hit him, no matter where it was, he'd grab his ear. It was just like, and hold his ear that way and jump around up and down like he was throwing a fit. That's why they eventually called him the Maniac Tolis. And as he got too old and couldn't do the knee drop off the top rope, or it wasn't work for him, he developed the dreaded corkscrew submission hold, which when you think about it is really not so dreaded, but he got it over. And that was, he'd get his opponent down, he'd take his finger and take his knuckle and put it in the guy's temple and just twist it around like a corkscrew. And that thing got over so big.
Right.
And when you think about it, it's just something you do to somebody on a playground, you know?
It's a great noogie of doom. And I love that, you know, it's a lesson a little bit for nowadays. You don't need to do the flippity-flop all about the ring, man. Just do a corkscrew.
And Blassie's finishing move was a move that's a transitional move still to this day. Actually, not a lot of people would do it because it's such an old move. It's the neck breaker.
Right.
Not the swinging neck breaker, it was just the neck breaker. They called it the southern neck breaker for some reason. I don't know why it was different than the northern neck breaker or anything else. But
which is, in terms of trying to apply logic to it, something called the neck breaker should finish the match.
Yeah, you would think it would. You would think it would, you know. So Tolis comes out here, and he's kind of the same way. He likes it out here. He goes off other places, but he likes it out here. And so in 1960, what happens is Freddie Blassie comes back after being in and out, and he comes back in a big way, and that is the NWA is gone. We're into the WWA, and he winds up feuding with Ricky Dozen and winning the WWA world title, and he basically holds that through most of the 1960s. And it is a tremendous run when you think about it. It's almost a decade run. And there it wasn't like you know, fans, after a while, they get bored with that character or they want to see somebody new. I mean, they broke it up here and there and they did stuff. But he ruled the territory. And he and Tolis wrestled during that time, too. Mm-hmm. You know, again, this was kind of like it, not it was even bigger, but, you know, when Andre and Hogan wrestled,
sure.
they used to say, oh, that was the very first time they've ever met. You
right,
know, but when in reality, they had wrestled several times. But right. the same thing with Tolis and Blassie. So what happens is they come upon, and I'm not quite exactly sure whose idea it was, but they come upon this idea of doing a show in the Coliseum. Now, remember, as I said, Michael Bell thinks there's only 10,000 wrestling fans.
Right.
You know.
Going to the Olympic.
But we're now into the 1970s. It's 1971.
Right.
And he thinks it's time to go ahead and to pop in to do this. Now, Blassie is 53 years old at this time.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, that's the amazing part is, like I said, Blassie was an older guy. I mean, he yeah. wasn't, you know, just such a young guy at that point. He had been around for quite some time. And he was kind of shot. You know, yeah. his body was... Now, then if you go to the Blassie history, Blassie had all kinds of problems and actually retired for several years and sold cars. Imagine him buying yeah. a car from Fred Blassie, okay? but he left and came back, and he was supposed to be out of the business, but he had that love for the business and he wanted yeah. to keep working. So they had to come up with an idea, a way to get Blassie out of the territory for a while. So they concocted this idea. And nowadays, this would never work mm-hmm. because they basically set up a scenario that made it look like Blassie was done wrestling. And what he did was, in that time, he went and had knee surgery done, mm-hmm. and then he went to Japan and wrestled. Now there'd be all over the internet right. the next day that he was wrestling in Japan, but back then, you know, it didn't happen.
There'd be insider scoop from yes. the locker room, Blassie's exactly. taking time off.
So at this point, Blassie holds the America's Championship, mm-hmm. which is the biggest title in the Southern California.
Yeah.
And on May 7th, 1971,
okay.
they launched this plan. And that is that Tolis wrestles Blassie at the Olympic. Mm-hmm. The ropes break. Blassie gets knocked out. He loses the belt to Tolis.
Gotcha.
Okay.
That's in May.
That's in May. The next night, on the live TV show, which is May 8th at KCOP, down at the mm-hmm. old studios down in Channel 13 on La Brea, I think it was down there. Everything is in place. They're doing the traditional Wrestler of the Year award, mm-hmm. and which is the old trophy. And everybody who's been a wrestling fan knows what happened. That trophy is going to get busted, whether it's over somebody's head or whether just on the ground, it's going to get busted. Well, they had a doctor who was the doctor, official doctor for the Olympic, Dr. Bernhard Schwartz.
Great name.
Right. Wonderful name. And he had his bag sitting there. And the award was given to Freddie Blassie mm-hmm. as Wrestler of the Year. And at that moment, John Tolis comes running into the studio, reaches into Dr. Schwartz's bag, and pulls out a bottle of Monsell's powder. Now, Monsell's powder is something that they use in boxing. Mm-hmm. Whenever a wrestler is bleeding, they would like a styptic pen. They would yeah. you know pat it down and do that. Prior to that, Jeff Walton and Mike LaBelle had gone through Bernhard Schwartz's bag and said, "Hey, is there anything here that can blind somebody?" Mm-hmm. And now it wasn't really the Monsell's powder they were throwing for real, sure. obviously, but they throw it into Blassie's eyes. Okay, mm-hmm. and Blassie and Dick Lane, who, again, I mentioned, was one of the best announcers of all time. Dick Lane's background was an actor. He was an actor mm-hmm. in B-movies. Blassie screams, "My eyes," and falls to the ground. Dick Lane goes nuts. Tolis runs from the studio yeah. before the studio audience comes after him. And now, this was kind of a hardcore angle that they weren't doing that much of back then.
Right.
And it actually is an angle, you mentioned the historical standpoint. They've done this angle over and over and over yeah. again everywhere else since then. Most famously, the Junkyard Dog did it with the Freebirds down in the Mid-South. And they've done it in different areas. And they did Jake Robertson, Rick Martel, the blinding angle. It's always one of the more popular angles. But it was really kind of tested here. I haven't found it to have been done in my research much anyplace else, really, outside of there. But so they throw Blassie into the ambulance and they take him over to the South Hoover Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Which I think in real life you would not want to go to the South Hoover Hospital. But that's where they took him. Now, again, the dedication to this angle, okay, the calls, people calling in.
Sure. It's live. This is a live broadcast.
Right. They went in and took pictures of Blassie in the hospital. And I believe he may have even stayed overnight just to be on the safe side with a patch over his eye. And they printed those out and they put them all out there. And so Blassie has his knee surgery.
Yeah.
And Blassie goes off to Japan. So they come on TV and they announce, very sadly, that Freddie Blassie is going to have to retire from wrestling, that he is lost. He only has 30% vision in his eye, and that that you know he can't go on. And they even have a moment of silence for him in the middle of the ring.
And this is happening in May as well.
This is happening in May
as well. May of 71.
Okay.
Gotcha.
Several weeks, months go by.
Mm-hmm.
No one mentions Freddie Blassie.
Not a word.
Freddie Blassie is gone. Now, where it does come up is Tolis is champion. Okay. Mm-hmm. And Tolis, of course, being the good heel, this is boasting about it. He's all happy about it.
Taking credit.
And fans are threatening to come after him all the time. And what happens is they wind up doing some of the most amazing box office they ever have. Mm-hmm. Because what they do is they bring in one person, one challenger after another. What he does is he's going to get revenge for Fred Blassie. I'm here to get revenge for Fred Blassie. So, in the meantime...
Who are some of these guys? Are they out-of-towners are bringing in?
Some are out-of-towners. Some people are stepping up. They bring in Mil Máscaras. Mil Máscaras, one of the biggest draws in the history of the Olympic Auditorium. He even beats Tolis one week, but then they reverse it. They do the old reverse. So, just when it looks like that Tolis is going to get his comeuppance, somebody snatches it back. Somehow he pulls it out and snatches it back. They go back and they find a guy named Don Carson. And Don Carson was a tag team partner with Freddie Blassie when they were both heels. So they bring Carson in as, you know, I'm here to fight for Fred Blassie. So they meet, I think it was around July.
Okay.
And miracles upon miracles, Carson beats Tolis to win the title.
Gotcha.
They set up a Roman Gladiator death match for the return match. Roman Gladiator death match is basically a strap match without the strap. The deal is you beat the guy up, and then you drag him to the corner, you touch the turnbuckle, and you go all four corners around. They do the return match, and Tolis just dominates Carson, beats him down, wins the belt back. All of a sudden, there is a noise coming up the aisle.
Mm-hmm.
And the fans start freaking out. Here comes Fred Blassie with an eye patch on, swinging a chain, headed toward the ring. The story is that Tolis, in complete panic, jumps out of the ring, runs as fast as he can, goes right out the back door, and gets in the car and leaves, and doesn't even want to stay around for that. Blassie, and actually you can find Dick Lane's recap of this online on YouTube. There's an audio version of this. You can hear him recount everything that happened the night before. So Blassie's pleading, and he's what they do is they go around the entire horn, the whole circuit, San Bernardino, Ventura, Bakersfield. Mm-hmm. They bring Blassie in once the show starts, and at some point he runs out and goes after Tolis.
Just replace this over and over.
Over and over again.
Just to spread the word.
Now, we're still... And so finally, they agree for a bout. It becomes a non-title bout.
Mm-hmm.
And it's revenge. Two out of three falls, just revenge. Yeah. Four. Now, imagine this with the way that wrestling is today. From that time until the August show, as much as he tries to, Blassie and Tolis never touch.
Right.
They never make contact with each other. Because why? Because they want you to pay money to see this. Now, in the meantime, while this was going on, where Tolis was fighting all these different challengers, For 14 alternate weeks, they sold out the Olympic Auditorium every show.
And they're not even touching.
Yeah. And, right. And this is when Blassie's gone still. These are people that just want to see Tolles get his butt kicked.
Gotcha.
Okay?
Gotcha.
We're building up to this even.
He's over, as the t-shirts would say.
Right. He's over, bro. And so what happens is that again, they're building to this, and everybody is just on, and they're just roaring, and they're hoping for a big crowd. So also in the meantime, they announce the Coliseum show. Blassie wants Tolles. They get that. Very wisely, every week they add another match. Mm-hmm. And these are matches that feature feuds that were coming to a head or guys that maybe have been in the territory and were coming back.
Gosh.
You know, like, for example, Bobo Brazil.
Yeah.
Very popular in the 1960s, bringing Bobo back. Who's he going to wrestle? Has to wrestle the Sheik. That's those guys have wrestled for 8,000 years. You might as well keep it going at that point. You have Black Gorman and Great Goliath, probably the greatest tag team in Southern California wrestling history, against Kenji Shibuya and Mr. Saito, heel versus heel for the America's title.
Mm.
I mean, this is a thing where, you know, whenever the four heels get in the ring together, you want to see who's going to kick whose butt.
Right.
You know, so you're building these matches up. And what happened also that was interesting was during those shows, those sold-out shows, and that was like about 10,400 you could fit in there, they came up with the idea, well, we can't get everybody in the Olympic. What if we did a close circuit to a local movie theater and people paid to go in there? And that's what they did. Mm-hmm. This was actually kind of the origin of pay-per-view.
Gotcha.
And people that couldn't get in, who got sold out, 10,400 tickets, couldn't get into the Olympic Auditorium for these other shows, they wound up paying, you know, money to go into a movie theater and watch that show. Again, that's where I'm hoping that one day one of these, somebody, some closed circuit has this thing tied
up.
So they set up the Olympic. I mean, set up the Coliseum. Ticket prices are $750, $5, $2 for the kids. Okay. Again, Blassie and Tolles haven't touched.
Right.
The go-home show, this is what they're doing on a Friday night. The go-home show somehow ended with Blassie being chained to the one of the turnbuckles, ring post, and Tolles starting to attack him while Dick Lane screams, "Get me the police, get me the police." Okay, again. Patience is a virtue in professional wrestling.
Again, folks, this has been building since May. We are now approaching the card late August, but now you're saying we've worked through July. We are now in mid-August here. Right?
Now we're in mid-August. Yeah. Now it's time to go.
Right.
And Jeff Walton has talked about how nerve-wracking it was going into that show because you had no idea if it was going to do well or not. Mm-hmm. I mean, they had picked August because it was a good time of year.
Sure.
Weather was going to be good. Mike LaBelle thought there was 10,000 fans.
Mm-hmm.
They were hoping for like 30,000. They thought it could go even as big as 50 if it pumped. Well, what's amazing when you think about it with Los Angeles, for a local wrestling group,
right?
They drew 25,847 fans to the Coliseum. Remember, that's the same Coliseum that they had to move the WrestleMania main event with Sergeant Slaughter and Hulk Hogan to the sports arena because they were afraid they weren't going to be able to draw that.
It was security concerns,
Dan. Yeah,
WrestleMania 7 moved because of security concerns.
Yes, exactly. So the night comes to the show, and there's those long tunnels, you know, in the Coliseum.
Mm-hmm.
And that way they can look up and down, and, you know, they can see what's going on. And Jeff Walton was always very vehement. This is where I got this. This is where when you do a show, you hang around and talk to the fans because you see what they think because they're the ones that are buying the tickets.
They're paying.
What do you like? What do you not like? Jeff Walton had not even told his wife. Talk about kayfabe.
Mm-hmm.
She thought it was real.
Right.
He didn't clue her in at all. You know, so she wanted a front row seat also for this so she could watch
She sold.
It.
Yeah.
She sold. You know, if you can sell your wife on something like that, then you know, then that's something.
Right.
That really is something. So the night of the show comes and they had this large crowd. Now, here is the offshoot of the, let me do this first. Okay, so Blassie and Tolles have their match.
Right.
Two out of three falls, they split the first two falls. Okay. In the third fall, it's not really a definitive finish because you don't really want to do that, but you can't send the people home unhappy. So Blassie was known as a biter. Mm-hmm. You know, so he started chewing on Tolis's forehead until Tolis bled, and they stopped the match because he no longer continued.
Right.
So, okay, the fans got to see Tolis bleed. They saw him beaten up, stumble back to the dressing room. And the plan is to go ahead and do all kinds of return matches afterwards. Fred Blassie and Mike LaBelle, the promoter, had a rather tempestuous relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Blassie was quoted in his book as saying, "I was always waiting for him to put a hatchet in my back." And LaBelle,
so the relationship between wrestler and promoter has never been
good. You know, that's and Mike LaBelle was always really irritated by this because Blassie flat out felt that he was cheated over his payoff at the Coliseum. Tolis wasn't very happy about his payoff either because they felt it was going to be a lot bigger. Blassie swears in his book that he saw ushers carrying bags of money out of the Coliseum before the show was even over. They were just doing it that way. So that kind of put a little bit of a damper on the return matches. Mm-hmm. Because the gate that night was $142,158.50.
Okay.
So it was a pretty good gate.
71,
so
Yeah,
I mean, I don't know what, you know, what they were expected to be paid, but I would say, with all honesty, they probably were correct in that they were underpaid.
Right.
The rest of the show was pretty much a gangbuster show. It went really, really well. Gorman and Goliath beat Saito and Shibuya to win the America's Tag Belts. Sheik beat Bobo Brazil. A lot of the results, I will tell you, because I haven't met anybody who was there, and I'm always trying to cinch these things up because there are a lot of results that are, you know, there may be a DQ or a count out or something there, and I think that's kind of important to know in those situations. And a couple of the and they printed in the paper, it got a lot of press in the paper. But two of the matches, the old you know, the LA Times had gone to press already, and they couldn't wait for the last two results.
Right.
But the odds are the Fabulous Moolah still held the ladies' belt. So there's a good, you know.
If you believe WWF and E! History.
Yeah, exactly.
Never lost it then, huh?
And I've never been able to find out, and watch, I will wind up after the show airs getting like 25 people saying, "You idiot." It's all over out there. But I don't know if the Solitario and the Mata match even took place. But the rest of the show was a pretty decent show. Again, it brought in the U.S. champion from San Francisco. And everybody went home happy, you know, except Blassie and Tolis, who didn't get paid. Tolis, it had a lot of this became their legacy,
right?
Tolis and Blassie. I mean, you know, it was something that they always came back to.
Where do they go from there? So they're feuding over. They think they've been underpaid. What happens to them from this point on?
Well, what eventually happens is that Blassie says the hell with it. And he leaves and goes back to the WWF back in the East Coast, becomes a manager eventually after a couple runs. His knees are giving out, of course. But this time, you have to realize by the time Blassie had this horrible last match with Lou Albano. In New York, and by that time Fred had to be in his 60s at that point.
Sure.
And there wasn't, and you know, the body was broken down. Though on occasion, what they would do out here is Tolis would go away for a while too.
Yeah.
But he would just go up to Portland for a little bit or up to San Francisco, and then he'd come back. You know,
right.
He was more of a mainstay through the last years than Blassie was. But every once in a while, if they needed to goose the box office, they would bring Blassie back, mostly in a tag match. They did do some matches here and there where they were singles matches. But most of the time, like they did a thing with the Hollywood Blondes, the original Hollywood Blondes, Jerry Brown and Buddy Roberts. We're running roughshod out here. Tolis was a babyface at that time, so he went out and got Blassie. Blassie came back, and they teamed up, and they taught the Blondes what for. Later in the last year of the promotion, like in 60, you know, in 80, 81, they brought them back for a cage match. And actually, videotape of this exists.
Really?
If you... and if anybody wants to write to me for it, but if you go to the special Blu-ray... special edition of My Breakfast with Blassie that my friend Johnny Legend did. He actually has the last cage match they did. It's not very pretty.
Sure.
But still, the fact was that almost 10 years afterwards,
yeah,
they still were going back to the well if they needed to.
They needed. And you're saying 80, 81. So Blassie's in his 60s in a cage match.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Now, they would put it in like a tag match so that way they could tag off. And Blassie comes in and gets the big, the hot tag and does all that stuff. But these guys will be inevitably married together to some extent,
right,
for their entire, and they actually really did truly like each other. Mm-hmm. They would occasionally create these great pictures, and there was one picture of Tolis and Blassie with their arms around each other, mm-hmm, smiling, and the picture was taken, and the whole idea was they said that they would take the picture if they promised it was never released.
Sure.
And actually, it was never released until after Blassie and Tolis had passed away.
Mm.
And the feeling at that point was that the business had changed. It was different. Everybody doesn't. If anybody out there still believes it's real, it's a little spooky at this point. But what they did was they basically someone put the picture out, and I have it, and I posted it on the page before. It's a great picture. It shows two guys that liked each other, that did good business with each other. And it showed that the camaraderie and the friendship they had.
You would think they'd have to be friends after all that time.
You would have to.
You'd think so.
You would
and
have
that's probably
to.
How it works best, I think.
I think it always does. I mean, there are stories of guys who feuded who never liked each other. But,
sure.
You know, they did that. But I think they, deep down, they had kind of the same sense of humor.
Yeah.
I remember one time John Toll was standing in the back of the San Bernardino Arena watching a match. And this woman, he was a babyface at that time, the woman said, I think you look just like Burt Reynolds. Burt Reynolds at that point was the number one movie star in the world, right? Tolis looks at her and goes, no, I think Burt Reynolds looks like me. Yeah. And that's just the way he was. He had a great, after Blassie had passed away, they asked him about it. And he goes, a feud like this only comes along once in a blue moon. Blassie and I were the right combination at the right time. We started to wrestle each other, and bingo, it just hit. Oh, man, we were both high, man. Every time I wrestled Blassie, I knew the house was coming down.
Mm.
Yeah.
Right.
And when you look at it in retrospect, it shows you the perfect way to book a feud.
Right.
And that, you know, granted, if you had the right components, you can take time. I mean, there's stories of Vince McMahon back in the 80s when he first was putting WrestleManias together, that he knew by WrestleMania what the next main event was going to be for WrestleMania the next year.
Yeah, and I still think they try.
In a
for
way,
that.
They try for that.
Things happen, injuries happen, but yeah, they know.
Yeah.
You know, where we're recording right now, we know that all the stuff going on with Triple H and Stephanie, it's leading to WrestleMania 30. They know ahead
that's
of time.
That's the whole idea.
But this is what you're putting out there, is that this was kind of the first big time where that build was used to amazing success.
In other
level.
Places, there were, I mean, it was a chance to take. I mean, because the payoff was the Coliseum.
Mm-hmm.
And if it failed, It was going to be pretty bad. Yeah.
Could you have seen it all? You know, it ended in 82, but could it have ended it earlier? Not maybe dead cold end in 71, but it would have.
I think they had enough of a roster at that point. They probably could have done something. I mean,
gotcha.
At that point, I mean, it was hot. It stayed hot for a couple years after that. Mm-hmm. It was only, when they weren't able to keep Blassie and Tolis, and all the other guys around on a regular basis, that they had problems. But that became the prototype, at least in Southern California, for those last 10 years of how to book that.
How to do it.
And I think if you look at a lot of the Southern promotions and a lot of places down there, you could do, World Class was a perfect example
of
that. World Class, you know, got so much mileage out of Gino Hernandez and Chris Adams.
Chris Adams against the
Von Erichs, or against the Freebirds. Versus Von Erichs.
Yeah.
And if you look at the really memorable feuds that people remember, even Hogan Andre went on for a couple of years.
Right. And involved a trophy.
Which is always the best thing in the entire world.
When in doubt, insert a trophy.
Exactly.
Into the feud.
Exactly.
As a jump start. What's we can talk about the aftermath and the legacy of this show.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond just the Tolis Blassie match, how do people look looked at, was it immediately recognized as history as it happened? Did people realize what it was?
I think they did. Much in the same way that when Bruno Sammartino wrestled Pedro Morales in Shea Stadium, that they realized that this was this that I think it was the first hint that wrestling could move to a bigger plateau. Because when you look at, I mean, again, those are amazing 14 weeks sellouts leading up to that. That if, you know, it's the Field of Dreams. If you build it, it will come.
Right.
And when you did that, and then also with the experimentation with closed circuit. Now, closed circuit was not unusual for boxing.
Sure.
But nobody was doing closed circuit for wrestling at that point.
How many, you maybe said, and I forgot, how many showed up to the theater? How much did that factor into?
They pretty much were full houses. Okay. So you figure, depending upon, those were mostly those theaters downtown in downtown Los Angeles, which were the older theaters. So I would figure they would probably hold 500 or whatever. Okay. And I mean, I think they did it in more than one, I think, because I know that Jeff Walton and Miguel Alonso, who was the Spanish announcer, did it. So I'm sure that there were was at least an English closed circuit, an English closed circuit, and a Spanish closed circuit.
Gotcha.
So again, I mean, that was the early, when people look back at the birth of pay-per-view, they always talk about that show.
Okay, yeah. And again, this is in addition to the 25,000 that showed up to the Coliseum.
Right, so exactly.
They're doing well. The experiment worked.
The experiment worked. And it did set kind of the pace for wrestling into the 80s.
Gotcha.
You know, even though you were 10 years away from that stuff, it showed you what wrestling could be. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the things all the promoters did back then was they took notice if somebody did well with something else somewhere else. And I think, I started seeing a lot of, doing things from the Astrodome or places like that after that. Because you knew you could take a chance. And now, again, in L.A., you're always going to pretty much have good weather.
Yeah.
You know, so you have a better chance of doing that. But I think that it was a show that still to this day people look back either fondly remembering the show or also looking at it as a textbook on how to promote professional wrestling.
It should be studied. I mean, I'm and learning from it from you right now. I'm like, oh, this is a textbook 101 on how to build, promote, and pay off.
And think about it again. Also, you're getting people to pay money, not a lot of money then, though. Supposedly but supposedly there were scalping tickets out front.
Yeah,
know.
Man.
But
you
then
got
that's
tickets. You need tickets.
Yeah,
I got tickets.
I got tickets. Remember, you're paying money to go to a stadium to see professional wrestling, where it's a little small little cracker with two little ants on it wrestling,
and you didn't have the jumbotrons, the
you didn't
big
have
entrance
that.
Ramps.
I don't know if they even had that. I don't believe they did.
You can't imagine that it did.
And imagine knowing how the layout of the Coliseum is, walking that long ramp, no music, no pyro. Just walking that long ramp.
Just booze and cheers.
Just booze and cheers. And that's the music they wanted to hear. They didn't need intro music. They wanted to hear the cheers and the booze. I think in some way that's kind of unfortunate for a lot of guys these days. And I think a lot of younger wrestlers when they're starting out, they spend a lot of time planning their entrance.
Their entrance, yes.
And I think it would be a really rude awakening if they took away the music and they heard how the audience actually goes. Because in many cases,
Could crickets be an entrance music?
Yeah. In a lot of cases, it's not unless you have that built-in audience that way.
And, hey, look, it's definitely something that's, I think, a great addition to wrestling. It adds to the pomp and circumstance. But what you're saying is you got to look to the core of what character you're developing as a wrestler.
And it would never have worked if Blassie wasn't Blassie and Tolis wasn't Tolis. I mean, you could have put other guys in there. It might have worked.
Right.
But the fact was you had the two right guys.
You had the chemistry.
You had guys that knew each other real well. They knew what the other one can do. They trusted the other one.
Right.
And they also were two bigger-than-life characters that, even though I've always felt like a lot of wrestling fans knew deep down in those days that it wasn't real. And if you throw someone in the ropes, they're not going to come bouncing back at you.
You would hope.
You would hope so. Yeah, yeah. And all that stuff. But I think the thing was that they liked Blassie.
Mm-hmm.
They liked Tolis deep down.
Right.
They wanted to see, this is what it boils down to with wrestling. They wanted to see two people beat each other up.
Right.
And they wanted to see, they wanted that cathartic thrust at the end where the good guy wins.
And to you, was the payoff what you wanted as a fan?
I couldn't wait to read about it. You had to wait 3-4 months at that point,
which is amazing.
There was a magazine called Wrestling News that came out that was a little more oriented toward the arenas, so maybe it cut it down to like two or three.
Right.
But still, I remember, because my whole thing was run down to the newsstand and get all the wrestling magazines.
Right.
And at that point, even, in the 1980s, there were thousands of magazines around.
Sure.
And I don't think there's like one or two now. It's
very small.
Yeah, very small.
I still like to just pop down in a newsstand at the farmer's market there in the brand. They got some wrestling magazines.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still tied to my childhood.
Yeah, yeah, it is. Yeah. I mean, I would go into, you go into the local pharmacy.
Uh-huh.
I remember the big ones. There was Wrestling World,
right?
And there was one called Inside Wrestling, and the After Mags, as they called them, the Bill After Mags. And then there was a Wrestling Monthly and Wrestling Review, and they were more scholarly, but they were farther behind.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where they would put results in the back, like of ring wrestling, but they wouldn't put the dates because they realized how far behind it was going to be at that point. But I remember going, and you can get, they were 60 cents a piece, and you pick up all of them, you run home, and hopefully they didn't have a bloody cover, because if they had a bloody cover, then your mom or dad would freak out, like, what are you buying?
Blashie's biting an ear off.
Exactly. And that's what you do, is you'd open it up and you would see, and they would do things like, when they were having the rematches, Tolos would wear neck gear to try to avoid being bitten or anything like that. But you got those magazines, and I couldn't wait to find out who won and whatever. And then when I found out that for a buck I could get the program,
right?
And I still have that program.
Yeah, lock that
up. It still floats around a little bit, but it was something where I wanted to have that, because for me that was having a piece of history. That was having a piece of that show.
Yeah.
And that's what I miss in a way, is nobody does programs anymore.
Right.
And in a way, the program was kind of like your connection, your memory of that show.
Right. I still got my first baseball game, 1988, the Padres Pirates.
Yep.
The Padres won 4-3 on a Chris Brown single up the middle in the 10th inning. I remember that, and I have the program to guide me through it. So, indie feds out there now, get some programs, for God's sake.
Exactly. I mean, it's not a bad idea. It's a good way for people to promote the show, and that's something that's a lost art. No one knows how to promote a show anymore.
No, you just do a Facebook page, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe a flyer somewhere.
Yeah.
Did LaBelle and his crew try to copy the success down the line here in the 70s following this? What other, in a short amount of time here, what other events did they try to put up?
Well, what they tried
did they
to
work
do
or
is,
not?
Well, a lot of them did work. We mentioned last time Piper and
the Guerreros
was a really big a big feud. Some people think that it went on too long. They kept bringing it back too much. Mm. But the fact was, they had very little to rely on at that point.
Sure.
They had a lot of guys who, and the story is always where, again, I will say this about Mike LaBelle. I feel in a way I've kind of slagged him the last couple of shows, and a lot of people would say that was fine. But he also gave a lot of people a chance. And I know that Jeff Walton speaks very highly of him, gave him a chance to come.
Well, my impression from the outside looking in is he had to have known what he was doing. He was a businessman first, and he ran a very successful business for a long time.
Well, yeah. I mean, and his father, his adopted father, Cal Eaton, was originally a member of the California State Athletic Commission, was assigned to the Olympic Auditorium to run it.
Gotcha.
He had his secretary, Eileen LaBelle, who was the mother of Gene and Mike. And they got married, and he adopted the kids, and they were raised. They were brought up around the Olympic, around wrestling. And Mike was basically a businessman.
Mm-hmm.
And a friend of mine one time had said something to him about, how could you do this or how could you do that? Because he was infamous about, if he didn't think it drew, then he wouldn't bring it back. Whether it made sense to bring it back or whether artistically you should bring it back, to continue this, it was like, no, that didn't work, so we're doing this now. Boom. We're going to abandon this, And somebody said to him something about, why did you do this? Why did you do that? And he said, hey, I'm here to make money. I'm not here to shake hands. And to the extent of that whole thing with him and Blassie, that really, he was very bitter toward Blassie toward the end of his life. To the extent of that, really and truly, Blassie was probably his number one draw through the 60s. Mm. But if you asked Mike in later years, Mike said it was Mil Máscaras.
Wrestling feuds go.
Yeah, I mean, it's.
I'm going to wrap up here shortly this has been fascinating. And for me to learn, I remember learning about Blassie and Tullis growing up because I grew up in that era where Blassie was the pencil neck geek screaming manager character. And then Tullis shows up as Mr. Perfect's manager, the coach for a while. And I was like, who's that?
That was the worst thing in the entire world because the guy could speak.
Right.
And they just blew a whistle. They make him a character, he blows a whistle. You know.
But I remember that's my first exposure to it. And that's why I love what we're doing with California Classic Wrestling, because some people are going to be exposed to some of these histories. That's how I learned. Like back in 1990, this guy comes out with Perfect, and who's that? Oh, that's John Tullis, and this is what he did. I'm so glad you got the chance to fill in this great history, great feuds.
And I was very lucky again to be a member of the Cauliflower Alley for a long time. Mm-hmm. And Tullis was a regular there, and he would hold court. Yeah. And he was, and I was sitting there with the table of my friends, and he would walk over and go, gentlemen, how are we this evening? You know, like that. And you go, this is John Tullis talking to me. You know, this is the best. Again, as I said before, you know, I can meet some of the biggest stars in the world today, and it's like, hi, how you doing?
Sure.
But if I get to meet a guy who was in the opener of the Olympic in 1965, I'm a happy man.
Outstanding. I know exactly what you're talking about. So this has been our retrospect and deep look at the greatest card in the history of California wrestling on August 27th, 1971 at the LA Coliseum, Blassie and Tullis. And this has been California Classic Wrestling on the Wrestling Viewpoint Network. And Dan, tell them quickly about Facebook, where they can find you on Facebook. Yes. And join the group.
Join the group. And we have a lot of fun. We have a lot of, I'm sure that when these shows first start airing, that we'll get a lot of comments on them and a lot of people probably adding to them. And that's something we hope in the future. And like I said, I joked about not knowing anybody who went to this show. If you went to this show and you have a memory of it, write to us. Tell us what it is.
Join the Facebook group or write to us at Wrestling Viewpoint Network. That's wrestlingviewpoint@gmail.com and say, I was there and here's what the memory was.
And that's one of the great things about the Facebook group is that it's something that everybody can add to. And you have people all the time that will say, oh, I remember this. And someone says, oh, yeah, well, I remember this, too. And you wind up creating this chain of memories. And oftentimes, you might solve a historical question that somebody's had for years, like who's this guy or what happened there or what happened that. And you'd be surprised how easy it is when you put together a network of people where you can get those answers.
That is the fun of that group, California Classic Wrestling. And Dan, where can they find you on Twitter?
Real Dan Farron on Twitter. I talk about a little bit of everything. It's not all wrestling, if you want to contact me or if you want to talk about the show, and if you have any suggestions, again, or any kind of advice or things you want to see in the show, let us know. I mean, this is something brand new. This is only the second show, and we're building from here, and we're going to be doing a lot of different things with the show, and it's really nice to be able to do it in a studio.
With AC, Central Air Valley. You can find me on Twitter at Kozpan, KOZPAN, and also find Wrestling Viewpoint Network on Twitter at WrestlingVN, that's at WrestlingVN, and don't forget to write us, WrestlingViewpoint@gmail.com. So until next time, for Dan Farron, I'm Ken Napsuk. This has been the California Classic Wrestling Podcast on the Wrestling Viewpoint Network. See you.